From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and Hillary Krieger, an editor with the Opinions and Editorial section at the Washington Post. And here are the issues. Middle East peace talks, a top priority of American Secretary of State John Kerry, broke down after Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas took steps to join 15 international organizations, a move defying both the United States and Israel. Meanwhile, NATO began an effort to protect members in Eastern Europe and thwart the aggressive behavior of Russia. And in Washington, President Obama announced that more than 7 million people had signed up for the new National Health Insurance Program. Well, Barbara, let me start with you. The Middle East peace talks have been really something that John Kerry has really emphasized. He's gotten a lot of criticism for it, but people saying, you know, that those talks couldn't go anywhere and he was spending too much time there. There were more important things to do. Well, that's two questions. What happened? And was John Kerry correct in emphasizing Middle East peace talks?
First, in your introduction, you blame Mahmoud Abbas, but in fact, the Israelis did not keep their part of the bargain. They were supposed to release some more Palestinian prisoners on March 29th. They did not. And then Abbas proceeded to go to his plan B, which is to try to get more international recognition of the Palestinian state that doesn't yet exist.
Well, let me add.
There are plenty of people you can blame. Yeah. As far as John Kerry, I think it was a valiant effort, but you also put the finger on it. You said John Kerry's effort. We've never really gotten the sense throughout this that President Obama has fully embraced this effort by John Kerry. And I think that's one of the reasons why the talks have failed. You know, if the United States is really serious about this, it's time the U.S. puts its own plan on the table and says to both sides, this is what we think is the best deal that either of you are going to get. You know, take it now.
I don't know about that. I mean, I think the key thing, I was expecting Barbara to go a slightly different direction when she said, well, it's John Kerry's plan, and that's the problem. The people that are missing from it are the Israelis and the Palestinians. And, you know, throughout this process, there have been some ups and downs, but the people that have been the most up.
I miss the ups.
The people that have been the most up have been people in Washington who've wanted something to happen. And on the ground, in terms of Israeli and Palestinian perspectives, it's been pretty pessimistic from day one. And getting towards the end of the 9 months that Kerry had outlined as a deadline for having a deal and then later sort of a framework agreement, you didn't see the Israelis and the Palestinians taking the steps they needed to reach a deal. Now you're seeing them take particularly counterproductive and antagonistic steps, but we had a lot of time until now for them to take affirmative steps, and that also wasn't happening. And so you saw Kerry acknowledge this reality finally when he said in response to these moves that the leaders, the Palestinians, the Israelis, need to lead. And what's interesting is that President Obama, at the beginning of his first term, did take an active role, did try. He didn't put together, lay out a plan, but he did directly get involved and see this as a major priority of his. And when also not succeeding in moving Prime Minister Netanyahu or Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, he too came to the same conclusion, mm-hmm. saying that, you know, we can't want it more than they do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we've really seen missing.
Barbara mentioned that the Israelis bear some of the blame here for this breakdown in the talks because they didn't release this fourth group of Palestinian prisoners. They let earlier three groups. I know the suspicion of the Israelis was that the Palestinians were not going to agree to a deal, but they just wanted to get all these prisoners out. And I know some Israelis feel vindicated now because they didn't let out the fourth and that ended the talks.
Sure, from the Israeli perspective, they felt that the Palestinians weren't making the steps that would be needed for not just a deal, but this more fuzzy framework agreement that mm-hmm. Kerry was trying to arrange in order to prolong the process, but also create a structure where you would be able to make progress on core issues. The Israelis felt they were trying to make that happen, and they were trying to find ways to get the Palestinians to be willing to continue the talks. And right before the Palestinian moves, actually, there were a lot of talks about the Americans and Israelis working out a package where Israel would make some concessions, including slowing down the pace of settlements in certain areas, continue with the prisoner release, and in exchange, the Palestinians would also agree to continue the talks. So certainly the Israelis see it differently. At the same time, there was an original agreement that was laid out at the beginning of the nine-month process that called for the Palestinian prisoners to be released on a certain day. The Israelis didn't do that. And the Palestinians, you know, one of their major concerns with any of these processes and sort of why you saw a nine-month deadline to start with is they feel that Israel just wants a process for the sake of a process. And it just drags out the status quo, which benefits Israel. So anytime there's talk of prolonging the conversation, the talks, the Palestinians see that as a concession on their part. So I think there's plenty of blame to go around. And the fact is that it's a very delicate situation, and it's ready to go off at any time. And, you know, there are many actors that contributed to this particular breakdown.
It's hard for me to believe that there is a deal that both sides could agree to. But anyway, what about, it was interesting what you said about President Obama, Barbara. There was no plan. What if there was an American plan and President Obama, as President Carter did, invited Abbas and Netanyahu to Camp David?
Well, that would show real courage and real leadership. This is the time you do it. If Carter did it in his first term, which was incredibly risky, Obama's in his second term. He has really nothing to lose. He got Obamacare through and all the rest. You know, if he wants to have a signature achievement, now maybe the gap was just so wide that Obama figured it wasn't worth it. But, you know, after all this time, I think the United States, I wrote a piece about it actually for VOA News a couple weeks ago. After all this time, I think the United States has a pretty good idea of what would be a feasible plan. And based on 67 lines with agreed territorial swaps, et cetera, et cetera. And at some point, I think the U.S. will have to put down a plan. It's the only way you're going to be able to bring these sides together. Time is not on anybody's side. Abbas is one of the more moderate Palestinian leaders. Who knows who will replace him? On the Israeli side, you have demographic issues. You know, Jews are increasingly a minority in, or will be, in the area that they control. You have a higher Arab birth rate, higher birth rate among Orthodox Israeli Jews who don't tend to want to serve in the military. This is not on Israel's side. And you do also have a kind of international atmosphere where support for Israel has gone down, even among American Jews, liberals who don't support Israeli policies. I was at an event a couple of weeks ago with Saab Erekat, one of the chief Palestinian negotiator. He said that the Israelis have added 10,000 housing units in the West Bank and East Jerusalem during the 8-9 months that these talks have been going on. So, you know, the Palestinian sense is the longer this goes on, the less land there is for us. And they apparently are going to go the other route to try to seek more and more international recognition and eventually force Israel into accepting a Palestinian state.
Weren't most of those new housing units in the suburbs of Jerusalem?
Yeah, some were, some weren't.
I think the majority
were. Erekat said there was more, quote, natural growth in the settlements than there had been in New York City during the same period. You know, so the Palestinians have a case.
More growth than New York. Well, that's interesting. Anyway, what about what I said to Barbara? And that is, if President Obama really committed himself, you mentioned that he was there in the beginning. We didn't hear much about the Middle East talks from him after that, and scheduled a Camp David. Certainly Netanyahu and Abbas would have to come. It would be risky on the president's part, but here he is. He's got 2.5 years left in his administration, and why not take a chance?
Well, I think the reason not is that, first of all, I do think Obama took a chance. I mean, I think that he didn't put exactly final status parameters, you know, at a big conference, but he was very involved and he put a series of different initiatives out there to try and get Israelis and Palestinians and the broader Arab world that was considered essential. And the Arab world essentially said, no, we're not going to do any of the things or make any of the concessions you'd like us to make. He did try that. Kerry right now has been trying for a framework deal that would have essentially, you know, said these are the basic things that we are looking at as the core parameters. And he did put a lot of pressure on the parties to do it. And the parties said no. And I don't think that if Obama had been the person, you know, more directly putting those parameters out there, it would have changed the outcome. I think, if anything, the fact that Obama took a little bit of a back seat and allowed Kerry to do quiet diplomacy is the reason we saw Palestinians and Israelis talking for 9 months, which we didn't see during the first administration when Obama was more involved. And I do think there's a risk. There's a risk that if the United States takes the sort of Hail Mary pass and it doesn't work, which I think at this moment all signs are that it wouldn't, because the leaders don't think that they don't fear the United States enough. Maybe that's the equation that has to change, but they don't fear the United States enough to feel absolutely forced to do more than show up. You risk, first of all, the U.S. having played out its hand, which I don't think really serves the U.S. going forward. And you also risk a more combustible situation in the Middle East. I mean, people talk about, you know, why shouldn't Kerry make this push? What's there to lose? And I think peace talks and the idea that you might have progress and creating conditions for those talks and all of that is not just positive, it's essential. And I'm not saying that no process is the better outcome. But the problem is that right now, when things collapse, which it's on the verge of happening, very likely we will face a more violent and certainly more dangerous scene than we have for quite some time. So there's also a real cost to it. And I think the United States just wishing something would happen isn't enough to make it happen, and you have to be careful and lay groundwork, and that would be the approach that I would see as being the preferable one.
Barbara, short of a strong intervention by the Obama administration and the president himself, where do we go from here?
That's a really good question. Basically what Kerry said in Morocco is that it's reality check time, mm-hmm. and that we're going to reevaluate now, you know, what to do next. There are plenty of other things on Kerry's plate. I mean, he can focus on sure. a number of other issues. He doesn't have to. You know, he's had something like 47 meetings with you know, with Israeli and Palestinian leaders, and he's gone to the Middle East I don't know how many times. So I'm sure he can find other things to fill out his schedule with, and he'll let them stew in their own juices for a while, and you know, perhaps something will come of it. But I'm with you, Fred. I think really, you know, the U.S. is going to have to intervene in a really significant way, and it's not just putting chips on the table like Jonathan Pollard. That was a mm-hmm. real sign of desperation talk that the U.S. Mm-hmm. was going to release this
explain who Jonathan Pollard is and what his role has been.
Yeah, Jonathan Pollard was an American Jew who was sentenced to life in prison in 1987 for spying on Israel's part on the United States. And he apparently gave over incredibly damaging information, very, very sensitive information on U.S. defense policies to Israel. It was a very sensitive case because it raised the whole issue of dual loyalties. Could you trust American Jews to, you know, be in sensitive positions, or would they really be serving an Israeli master? Very, very sensitive issue, really divisive for the American Jewish community. Now, he is up for parole, I believe, next year, and the Israeli government, which gave him citizenship in 1995 and admitted he had been their agent in 1998, has been trying to get him freed. You know, it's something that's raised regularly by the Israeli government. So the idea is that the U.S. would have sweetened the deal in terms of Palestinian prisoner release by giving the Israelis Jonathan Pollard. But it remains a very controversial issue in this country. And as I said, I think it was a sign of desperation about the talks that this was even raised.
Well, it was leaked to the press, and it certainly, if it was a trial balloon, it was fairly well shot down, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, again, there are divisions of opinion. There are some who've suggested why not. But, you know, I would put Pollard in if the Israelis and the Palestinians sign a final status agreement. You could put it in then, but not mm-hmm. just to prolong this endless process of talking and getting nowhere.
Mm-hmm. I asked Barbara the where do we go from here question, Hillary. I'll ask you the same question. Where do we go from here?
You know, this is why I'm a journalist and not a policymaker. I just get to write about all the bad things that happen as opposed to come up with solutions. I mean, I think, first of all, right now, there is a role for the U.S. to just convince the sides to step back from the brink. There's really threats of rapid escalation in terms of not just the rhetoric, for sure, but also taking real moves that inflame the situation. So the Israelis now are talking about sanctions against the Palestinians, like withholding tax revenue that should go to the Palestinian Authority, and maybe restricting some access of Palestinians. And the Palestinians now have apparently up their demands in terms of what is needed to resume the talks, you know, basically listing a whole bunch of things that Israel has to agree to from the start in terms of where the borders would be, et cetera, that Israel won't agree to, which makes the process of sitting down much harder.
Are there any positive things that could happen now? This is what I was really looking for, that might move the peace process, which, largely speaking, the peace process that wouldn't involve maybe personal negotiations or at least ones we knew about, that can happen now, or do we just have a lull?
I mean,
or a pause or something like that?
Again, in the short term, the best case scenario is really just getting the sides to calm down and quiet down. You can read what's happening now is just more posturing and positioning, and that somebody, I think, in the New York Times was quoted saying this is negotiating out loud, whereas until now we've had people negotiating in quiet. And so, you know, if it's really just a series of positioning, and that can be harnessed to actually come to, you know, a framework for moving forward. The actual deadline for this process that Kerry outlined is the end of April. So there is sort of, in theory, another month to keep going. Then perhaps after having gotten through this bad stretch, it would put leaders in a sort of renewed, better position. I just think that's highly unlikely at this point.
Barbara, let me try one other thing on you, and that is,
sure,
President Abbas has been in office for 10 years. He was only elected for 4, but they haven't had another election, and he's still there. I think he's generally regarded as a fairly weak leader. It makes him hard for him to make concessions. He'll be obviously highly criticized. Could a stronger leader that in the beginning the Israelis and the Americans might not like actually be better for an ultimate solution?
Yeah, I suppose, but then you have to have Palestinian elections, and then you have to decide what you're going to do about Gaza, which is currently run by Hamas. The Palestinians had a strong leader. His name was Yasser Arafat, and the Israelis kept him a prisoner in his own headquarters until he got sick and died. So,
and the Israeli narrative would be that he had the chance to make a peace deal and he turned it down. So,
and then the Israelis made him a prisoner in his own headquarters
until he got sick and died.
But well,
you know,
true.
There's a guy named Barghouti who's a prisoner in Israel, who would be a very strong leader for the Palestinians, but the Israelis say he's a terrorist. Look, we don't know what the future will bring. And eventually, somehow, perhaps, there will be a resolution to this crisis, but it's really hard to see now.
And just on the Barghouti thing, I just would say the reason Israelis say he's a terrorist is because he was convicted of, you know, being involved in attacks that killed a lot of civilians on riding buses. But it's interesting, his name has come up as part of the prisoner exchanges because while he hasn't been on the list so far, now that, again, the Palestinians have apparently upped their demands, they've put his name on the list. And it's an interesting move because it would actually threaten Abbas's position to have him reemerge on the scene. But because he is a much stronger leader with a lot more credibility on the ground, if he were to be released, that's something that could really change the dynamic. I think it would have to take a calculation on Israel's part that they are willing to take that risk. And I don't... Netanyahu has been a pretty risk-averse leader, so it seems pretty unlikely. But I think, you know, we often talk about this in the Middle East, waiting for the right leader to come along. And so the fact that you've seen Barghouti's name for the first time in a while means that that's something that could change the dynamic.
All right. Well, we've discussed that at length. I've gone past when we were supposed to have a break, but we'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder, you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on The Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Hillary Krieger of the Washington Post and Barbara Slavin of AlMonitor.com. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues Online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com. Hillary, let me start with you on NATO. NATO's pulling out of Afghanistan, and now they seem to have a mission again, which was their traditional mission, which was to impede. It was the Soviet Union, now Russia. What should we expect from NATO? And, you know, there's been talk of putting troops, small numbers of trainers or whatever, in the Baltic states, and maybe some in Poland, and basically the countries that are that border Russia.
Right. I mean, they're looking at Russia's, you know, moves that don't seem to have been impeded in any way so far by the current rhetoric and certain we've seen moves in terms of giving money to Ukraine and certain international sanctions and international forums against Russia, et cetera. And so there's a question of, you know, NATO, this military force that's actually supposed to be protecting these areas. Is there some way that they can step up and be more assertive and basically send Russia the message, not that it's NATO is going to push Russia out of Crimea, but the real concern is, will Russia go further into Ukraine, threaten other of it, the former Soviet countries, and that this is a first move that can send a message to Russia, hey, don't do that, because we're still a force, and mm-hmm. there are things that we can do. And it also psychologically is important for these Eastern European countries who feel very vulnerable to Russia. They see what's happened in Ukraine, to do something to say, you know, we're behind you and you shouldn't feel as concerned as you do. Ukraine, you know, had an agreement before Russia came in that in the 90s, it gave up nuclear weapons. And as part of that deal, the U.S. and Russia had agreed that, you know, this major concession would be accompanied by an agreement not to violate the territorial integrity of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. That obviously has now been voided. And so other Eastern European and former Soviet satellite countries are thinking, well, could we be next? Russia's obviously not going to stand back if we don't have something supporting us. So I think it's important in that regard.
You know, Ukraine is getting $1 billion from the U.S., Barbara, but, you know, I was a little surprised at the interview with the Associated Press that former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych said that he's going to try to advise Vladimir Putin to pull Russia out of Crimea. I mean,
that was hysterical. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and very sad. Look, you know, he's a failed puppet of the Russians. Mm-hmm. The whole crisis was because of first he decided to sign an agreement with the European Union, and then he changed his mind. That's what sparked the months of demonstrations mm-hmm. that eventually led to his downfall. You know, he finally fled in the middle of the night, and now he's saying, you know, that he's going to ask for Crimea back. It's a little late. Crimea is being absorbed completely into yeah. Russia. They changed the clocks now. Mm-hmm. They moved them ahead a couple of hours so that Crimea would be on Russian time. You know, various things are happening now. Apparently McDonald's is no longer functioning in Ukraine. And also Ukrainian addicts can no longer get methadone. Interesting ramifications.
Well, what about NATO?
NATO is prudently, you know, as Hillary said, shoring up the other former Soviet republics, which I think is a very wise move. And what we have now is basically signaling going on. I think everyone understands that it's too late to get Crimea back. So this is signaling Putin, don't you dare take any of those 50,000 troops that are on the border with eastern Ukraine doing quote-unquote maneuvers, don't you dare move in. But Russia has other ways of playing this game and that are frankly almost as worrisome. We saw this week that the Russians have increased the price of natural gas once again, doubled it to $485 per 1,000 cubic meters, which is more than Europeans have to pay for natural gas from Russia. Mm-hmm. So they have plenty of economic cards that they can use to really squeeze the Ukrainian government. And I think ultimately, as Ukraine goes forward with elections and so on, the Ukrainians have to be very aware that they've got to come up with a new government that will take Russia's concerns into consideration, that they're not too pro-West, certainly not in economic terms, even though they've gotten a big bailout from the European Union. This is going to be very delicate going forward, and the best we can hope for is that the Russians will stay on their side of the border when it comes to eastern Ukraine and be satisfied with Crimea.
One of the things that Putin doesn't seem to take very seriously, Hillary, is signals from the United States or the Europeans, Chancellor Merkel of Germany or any of them. He seems to do what he wants to do. I just wonder whether NATO, whether you think, I mean, we don't know for sure, whether NATO, was there anything really bold enough that NATO might do that would be a signal that he would have to pay enormous attention to?
I think that NATO is much more reluctant to use force and to be aggressive than Putin is. There's no question about that. But Putin...
And he must know that.
Right. But at the same time, you know, Putin's a shrewd guy and he's calculated, you know, in the past what he could do, what not. He moved into Georgia, for instance. He, you know, militarily, he could have taken over the whole country and he didn't. I think that he's been, you know, willing to hold off if for various reasons that are his calculation, not necessarily because he is particularly afraid of NATO per se, but the consequences of the confrontation might not be worth his while. Just for instance, if NATO bolsters militarily Eastern European countries, that will limit his opportunities down the road. So NATO might not confront him as directly and as aggressively as he'd be willing to confront others, but he also doesn't want a situation in which he has repositioned NATO to be in a much more advantageous position than it formerly was. And so I think that he's enough of a chess player that even short of a really strongly affirmative aggressive stand, NATO's maneuvering could affect him. Now, that's a could, not a will. So it's it still remains to be seen how he takes it.
You know, I still am not sure the answer to this question, Barbara, and that is what Putin wants. You know, he said, broadly speaking, he would like to reconstitute a Russian empire, and that could be countries that are taken over, satellites or whatever. What is it just not clear what he's really talking about?
He wants to be popular in Russia, and he wants to be feared more than loved abroad. He wants to be considered an important leader in the world.
Well, he's achieved that, don't you think?
I suppose he has, so let's hope he's satisfied for now.
Okay, that's all we have. Apologies to President Obama for not going into his health care plan, which now had more than 7 million people sign up. Join us today. We're Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council and Washington Correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and Hillary Krieger, an editor with the Opinions and Editorial section at the Washington Post. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.